The following program was pre-recorded. On WFAN, it's time for Hello, My Name is Craig, our weekly candid conversation about gambling addiction. It's supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER. Now, here's Craig Carton.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Hello, My Name is Craig. Craig Carton with you for the next 30 minutes, a frank, open, honest conversation about gambling addiction and compulsive gamblers like myself. And as always, my main man, Dan Trelaro, joins us. Danny, good morning. How are you?
I'm well, Craig. I'm well. Good morning. How are you doing today?
Doing great. Thank you, as always, for spending your Saturday morning with us. And happy to have Dr. Leah Nauer, the lead researcher over at the Rutgers Gambling Studies Program here in the Garden State. Dr. Nauer, appreciate your time, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's interesting to me, you know, that you're in New Jersey because it's really the state that started it all. And I wondered if you could kind of give us, in your expertise and the capacity of your job as the lead researcher, kind of an overview on where we are when it comes to young people gambling, whether it's, you know, how often they're doing it, the problems that, you know, we're finding now, and what type of issues you see coming in the next 6 to 12 months in regards to younger people who are now gambling for the first time.
Sure. So just by way of context, we evaluated our center, the Center for Gambling Studies, every bet placed in the state of New Jersey for both sports wagering and iGaming. And what we're seeing on the sports wagering side in particular is that more and more younger people are betting. And we also conducted a statewide prevalence survey, and those findings were alarming because the average emerging adult, particularly among those who are 18 to 27, they endorse problem symptoms at much higher rates as, you know, of everybody who gambled. About 18% were at high risk, which would be, you know, a gambling disorder type symptom compared to about 6% across the whole New Jersey population. So that's the first thing.
Is that easily written off as just a lack of maturity?
I think there is higher rates of impulsivity and general risk taking. But one interesting finding was the rates were much higher among those who had family members and household members who gambled. So that's suggesting there is really an influence of this modeling.
I mean, it makes sense to me. If gambling has been normalized in your household, your dad does it, an older brother does it, an uncle does it, you know, you're more likely to do it because it's, you know, it's seen behavior and it's copycat behavior. The thing that, and I'm not sure how you could study this, but I'm wondering if you have. You know, Dan and I have talked a lot on this show, and more Dan, and Dan, you could speak to this, so please do. Where a lot of the young people on college campuses that are now gambling, many of them, for the first time, certainly the first time legally, have said repeatedly, I don't gamble, I just bet on sports. And I'm wondering, Dan, if you could elaborate on that, and then Doc, if you could, you kind of, you know, give us your thought process on that.
Yeah, Leah, it's funny, when you and I were chatting, I guess, a few weeks ago, we were down at the State House, one of the things that I've been on over, I guess, 80 to 100 college campuses in the last several years, and that always strikes me, whether I'm talking to Greek life, even college students and then student athletes who shouldn't even be betting on sports because it would be a violation of NCAA, depending on the type of sport. But when they say that, I say, can you help me understand that you don't see sports betting as gambling? And they say, well, no, it's not pulling a slot machine. It's not like my uncle or my father. You know, I know better. I've studied. I've researched. So it's almost as if they think that they have a higher win expectation because they're either knowledgeable, they follow it. Can you talk about some of that and what you're seeing in the research and also just some of those, I guess, those cognitive distortions, right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly what you're talking about. I mean, we have terms for them like biased evaluation and illusion of control. But at the end of the day, what we're talking about is, you know, people get a system when they sports bet and they think they have a winning system, but they don't factor in all the chance things that, of course, make this why the house always wins. You know, I mean, sports bets in New Jersey lose 70% of the time, and parlays can lose up to 90% of the time. But you feel that if you have, and this is particularly true of athletes and coaches, we have somebody in our center who really focuses on problem gambling among that group. And because they feel they're so knowledgeable about the sport, they feel like that translates into sort of them being a better.
Yeah, I've seen that. And Craig, you talked about, like, you know, it's almost like that the online prediction services also kind of flow into this.
Well, I've always had a problem with those, you know, because there's no such thing as a really good or successful quote-unquote handicapper. They're all full of crap. You know, that's why they're referred to, you know, negatively as scamdicappers, because what they are essentially are great marketers. They're not great at picking games, because the reality is that very few people are great at picking games, specifically when we're talking about, you know, sports wagering. You can make an argument that there are some casino games that if you have a mathematic brain, you can process numbers quickly. Well, blackjack, you know, everything that happened before dictates what happens next. It's a game of probability. But even at that level, there's no more than maybe 10 or 15 legitimate card counters in this country at any one time. So it's fool's gold to think you have a system that over the course of the long haul is going to win. You can have short-term success, 100%. But if you're playing regularly, every day, every week, over the course of a long period of time, you are ultimately going to lose. And that's just the fact that, you know, I could back that up, as I'm sure Dr. Leah could. You know, with stats upon stats. Doc, I guess, you know, my big concern or problem, to be fair, that I have, not just with New Jersey, but New York and every state that's legalized it, is that all of a sudden you have this never-before-existing windfall of money from a tax benefit standpoint, right? And there are very few to almost zero nationwide gambling-specific rehab centers. And I'm wondering, when you do all the research you guys do, and you're right there on the front line of data, you can say to legislators and healthcare professionals and gamblers and parents and everyone, A to Z, we're looking at an epidemic. I know we don't like using that word. Maybe it's overused. But why isn't that we're forcing these states to also use some of that money to create centers where people like me, people like Dan, can walk in the front door and ultimately get the help that they need?
It is not a priority. First off, let's start at the federal level. The federal government makes a lot of money off gambling. And yet there is no federal regulatory body. There is no federal funding for research or prevention through the National Institute of Health. I mean, they are just silent on gambling. And that trickles down to the states. So it's totally up to the individual states. And typically what they do is just throw a little money at some problem gambling initiative that's, you know, not evidence-based, and they give money to treatment, but then no one comes. So then that money gets funneled off somewhere else. Now, Louisiana does have an inpatient, and there are some states that actually have developed a framework, but we don't have frameworks in place, and that starts at the top with that being a priority.
Got it. Right. And then when it comes to money, if they can hang on to it, I get that part of it. They're going to hang on to it. When you guys do this research and you're looking at 12 months from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, et cetera, which I imagine is part of the predictive nature of doing the research, because you're trying to get ahead of a problem before it happens. Walk me through for you guys what, like, the doomsday prediction is in regards to the amount of younger people that are going to present with some level of compulsive gambling or gambling addiction.
It's bad. Those of us that work in this field, it's like, you know, watching a car crash about to happen, and, you know, you can't turn away and you can't do anything about it. I mean, when you're looking at, just in our prevalence survey, when you're looking at, you know, the youngest cohorts having rates of high-risk problems three times the rates of other people. And you're looking at illegal gambling among those underage. And this is all sort of sanitized and glamorized. And people, we did a study, interestingly enough, of adult social workers and psychologists who actually were practitioners. And among the ones that had problem gambling symptoms, about 60% said they didn't even gamble. So people, there is a stigma attached to the label of gambling and gambler that people don't, that is sort of in the way of us helping people.
Right. Yeah. I talk all the time. I hate that term degenerate. You know, if you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic. If you're a drug addict, you're labeled a drug addict. But for some reason, when it comes to gambling addiction, which is a recognized addiction nationwide, we have to throw that adjective in front of it, which is why what person wants to raise their hand and say, hey, I'm a degenerate? Nobody wants to. So, you know, right. I think that's part of the stigma. But I do think, and this may be, I don't know, somewhat counterintuitive, that the more mainstream the gambling becomes, and by proxy, the conversation at the dinner table, father to son, mother to daughter, sibling to sibling about gambling, ultimately, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not 5 years from tomorrow, but knock on wood in my lifetime, I think it will ultimately make it easier for somebody who does have a problem to come forward, because there will be a day, much like it is for drinking. You know, we did live through Prohibition 120 years ago, where gambling will be so normalized that it'll be easier for somebody to raise their hand and ask for help. And I wonder if you agree with me on that or not.
I totally agree with you. I hope it happens in my lifetime.
Sure.
Or my career lifetime.
Yeah. And Dan, what are your thoughts about that when you talk on these college campuses? You know, I give speeches, you know, as you do. I'm actually going to a high school, you know, next Thursday to talk to a father-son group about a couple hundred kids at a private school in New Jersey that asked me to come speak to them about it. As you travel the country, do you find that kids are more willing to raise their hand or less willing?
It's a great question. Yeah, I remember when I started doing this, I guess, you know, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, even with the New Jersey Council 6 years ago, when you would ask people, how many of you in a setting, you ask young emerging adults, how many of you have ever known someone who had a drug or alcohol problem? And the number of hands that go up is always, you know, upwards of 75%, you know, three quarters of the room. When I used to ask questions about how many people do you think have a gambling problem? The hands didn't really go up, right? Because they didn't really know, maybe. They weren't sure. Fast forward to today, in the last couple of years, when I'm asking college student athletes, high school individuals, coaches, staff, the hands that go up for gambling are almost identical to the number that go up for drug and alcohol. So we're normalizing the conversation. We're getting the word out. We're starting to do it. But it's a slow train. It takes a long time. And, you know, like, Leah, to your point, like, I would love to see this normalized in conversation in our lifetime, because it's the mental health, right? It's the co-occurrence with alcohol use. It's mental health issues. It's suicide. There's so many factors to this, but people just think that a person with a gambling problem has a money problem, and they don't realize that it's really an emotional problem where the money problems are the result of that emotional problem.
Let's take a quick break. This is Hello, My Name is Craig.
Back to more of Hello, My Name is Craig on The Fan with your host, Craig Carton, and supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER.
Welcome back to Hello, My Name is Craig. Dr. Leah Naur, the lead researcher, runs the Rutgers Gambling Studies Program in New Jersey, and of course, Dan Trillaro. Doc, I guess as you collect all this data and you acknowledge that it's a problem, and younger people, you know, statistically are, you know, three times thus far more likely to get themselves in hot water. If you were going to recommend some type of solution to the problem or some type of advertising or marketing campaign to make parents aware of what their kids might be doing, what have you guys come up with to try to knock those numbers down a bit?
That's tough, because it goes back to the problem that there's not really, I mean, advertising on TV and those kind of things to counteract this sort of blitzkrieg of ads from the industry requires a lot of money.
Right.
And there isn't any money for that. So we sort of think about starting small, starting in schools, starting in high schools. We've had kids come to our center, and 50% of the boys who are in eighth grade have said they've already placed sports bets.
Wow.
with their parents. So, you know, educating the parents, the teachers, coaches have high rates of problem gambling, and they are modeling for all of these athletes. So, you know, until we get more awareness at the top of the state level and the government, the federal government level, I think we have to start small and grassroots.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, Dan. We talk a lot about, you know, and I, when I talk, you know, to college kids as well, you know, it's the athlete, it's the type A personality, the successful, the go-getter. I have found that they're more likely to gamble than the ones that aren't like that because, you know, they like the competition. They don't like to lose. Mm-hmm. So if you take, you know, a 19, 20-year-old kid who shouldn't be gambling anyway, but I'm not going to be silly. I had a drink before I was 21. You know, so, you know, we can't, you know, keep our heads in the sand. Kids are going to experiment and do things like we did, whether it was drinking or, you know, the first joint you smoked or whatever the case may be. The reality is that the successful, driven kid is also, Dan, the kid that's more likely to have a problem, right?
Yeah, there's, you know, one of our good friends for all three of us, Dr. Tim Fong from the UCLA Gambling Studies Program. We've had him on a couple of times, and you know, Lee and I have known him for years as well. You know, he always talked about the personality traits of athletes, and there's a few personality traits that really lend themselves to potentially developing harmful behaviors, and some of them are, you know, that the resiliency aspect, right? Resiliency is a great quality to have. But it also let you continue in an activity that might be ultimately slowly hurting you. So they're resilient. They have a fear of failure. They're taught as athletes, the more you practice, the better you'll get. But that does not apply to things of life like drinking and smoking pot and gambling. You know, it'll hurt you in the long run. And athletes have a fear of failure. They're risk takers by nature. But the difference is they understand an appropriate risk. But now we have this new world where they're experimenting with this thing where they may not fully understand all the risks or they don't see the harmful side effects.
Yeah, Doc, I will tell you a story just to get your take on it. A good friend of mine has teenage sons. They know my story, you know, of compulsive gambling, et cetera. So he came to me and he asked what I thought about. They let their 15-year-old make sports bets. So mom or dad opened up an account on one of the websites and the kid has unfettered access to gamble. And they asked me what I thought about it. My initial reaction was, when he loses, who pays the credit card bill, right? And the answer was, well, you know, the parent does. And I said, well, you're setting your kid up for a real problem because he has no idea what it's like to lose. He's never once paid off the debt. And I think as much as we want to focus our attention on young people, and we should because they're the largest and fastest growing segment of the population that's now gambling, it still comes down to how much are mom and dad paying attention to what their kids are doing, right?
I totally agree with you. I mean, the parental modeling aspect, and not just parents. One of the studies we did showed that brothers and sisters' behavior, as well as other members in the household, are equally influential. And the kids that are raised in households where they model this type of gambling behavior and even let them participate, those kids go on to not only have higher rates of gambling, but also drinking, drug use, and other behavioral type addictions. And so this sort of transgenerational effect is real. And we see it, we saw it for years, and Dan probably could speak to this, with the horse race bettors. I mean, a lot of those people who bet on horses, high proportion, have serious problems, and their dad used to take them to the track, and their grandfather took them to the track, and now we're seeing that exact same thing with kids in sports betting.
Well, right, and then the side problem is that because of the phones that every single kid has, you don't need your mom or dad to take you to the track. Your parents may not even know about it because you can do it exclusively on your phone.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And there's something similar between horse race handicapping and sports betting, right? Because it's also the same thing with picking a stock in the stock market, if we're being perfectly honest. Mm-hmm. You know, the concept of research goes into all three. You know, analyzing bits of data to try to formulate an opinion of who you think will win or make money or make you feel good, whatever you're looking to achieve. And there's a process that goes on it. And the process can be just as, habit forming and make you feel good and release the chemicals as you're going through it. So for some people I've talked to, it's not even the actual placing of the bet, because then there's a boredom, there's a lull factor after the bet's been placed. It's the experience and the excitement of the handicapping and the researching of who they will choose.
Dr. Naur, before I let you go, I'm friendly with Matt Palatkin, and I know as Attorney General, you know, he's concerned about where gambling is going in the state of New Jersey because of all the things we've been talking about. So I wonder, and I say this, you know, respectfully to you, you guys put an inordinate amount of work and time into the research that you've done. And now you've got a document that you can show the world about, you know, where our kids are going and the potential problems and, you know, pitfalls for young people gambling. And I'm wondering, as I'm listening to you talk over the last half hour, now that we have the research and the empirical data to support that we're looking at, my word, no one else's, an epidemic for young people when it comes to gambling. What do we do with that research? What do we want the state to do with that research? And how do we use that research for good?
That's a great question. I think we have to have a framework in place that sort of that incorporates all the different places where people can present it. We have to have evidence-based practices in place rather than just throwing money here and throwing money there. I presented in front of the Joint Senate, that's where Dan and I were both, the Senate and Assembly Committee, and they were looking at this question. I think we have to have, you know, a much more logical and conceptually holistic approach to addressing this on a state level.
Yeah, and I know how that goes with the red tape, and I know New Jersey, but every state's similar in that regard, where people do want to do the right thing and help out. It's a matter of how do you do it and who's got the money to pay for it, ultimately, at the end of the day. Final thing for you, Doc. You know, like I said, I am going to talk to a high school next week. It's interesting. I've been asked by a lot of high schools to come in and speak, and I always say yes. And then invariably, the PTA finds out about the speech, or, you know, the principal gets brought into the loop, and they don't want teenage kids, high school kids specifically, to be exposed to that type of speech. And I respect that. You know, each community is very individual when it comes to that. I'm wondering your take on, is it proper for someone like me, for Dan, for yourself, to go in and have an assembly and be real and raw and honest with 15, 16, 17-year-old kids? Or do you think some of these school districts are right in thinking we don't want to have that talk just yet?
They're dead wrong. They're dead wrong. If we didn't have, you know, the DARE program, if we didn't have, you know, some of these scared straight things where people really are, kids need to understand the reality of the downside of what they're doing. Otherwise, they just think this is a game. And I think what you're facing, given your history, is stigma associated with your background. Like, well, he's not typical. This isn't going to happen to my kid. And people need to understand this is every bit as serious as drugs or alcohol.
I'm with you on that. And I think you're right. You know, we want someone who went to prison, you know, talking to our kids. Doc, I could talk to you forever. I'm up against it. Thank you so much for your time and appreciate what you're doing here in New Jersey. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Leah.
All right, Dan, great having Dr. Lee. I appreciate you setting that up. And we'll do this again next week with a bit of a holiday special, as it'll be our last show prior to Thanksgiving. We'll come back, of course, in December, leading right up to Christmas. Always appreciate your time, pal. Any last thought or word you want, go ahead.
Yeah, no. Dr. Naur and I have known each other for years, and she does great research, and they provide research to the state, and the stuff that she's finding is consistent, Craig, with the stuff that we talk about. You know, so we're on the right path. We've got to get the word out to these young emerging adults, and it's just a slow-moving train. Like you said, it's like watching a car crash, you know, and we're watching it happen in real time.
I always appreciate you. We'll do this again next week. Joe Benning goes next. Thanks so much for listening to Hello, My Name is Craig.